Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome, welcome. Well, if you're in a relationship with someone who unfairly judges you, who routinely criticizes you for things that are beyond your control, or who blows things out of proportion, listen up. My first guest is Dr. Michelle Skeen, and her latest work can help end the criticism and bring you the love you want and deserve. And I'll introduce her in just a moment. Coming up around 12:25, we'll be joined by Stanford professor and physician Dr. Abraham Verghese, and I have no idea how to say his last name, so we'll have to figure that out when he's on. But he shares his belief in the power of the physician's touch. He actually believes that a doctor, even before they pick up a stethoscope, should know exactly what they're going to hear. He says we place far too much emphasis on CT scans and other medical tests and not enough on physical touch. He's also an award-winning New York Times bestselling fiction author, and we'll talk about how his writing actually helped him in his medical career. And we'll end today's show with legendary TV and radio broadcaster Larry Kane, who's turned the tables on the media industry with his new novel. It's called Death by Deadline. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Michelle Skeen to the show. She's a therapist who lives and works in San Francisco. She's the co-author of the forthcoming book, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy for Interpersonal Problems, and the author of the book we're discussing today, The Critical Partner, How to End the Cycle of Criticism and Get the Love You Want. Dr. Michelle Skeen, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Vicki.
Well, let's get a little bit more background in here, Michelle. I want to just let our listeners know that you've worked with long-term and short-term patients, providing long-term and short-term therapy, I should say, for individuals and couples utilizing schema, cognitive, and behavioral therapies to address all kinds of issues. Tell us a little bit about your work on a daily basis.
Well, a large portion of my work is using schema therapy, which was developed by Jeffrey Young. And schema therapy is the idea that we is based on the idea that we all have schemas that are created through during childhood and adolescence, through interactions with parents, siblings, caregivers, and peers. And Jeffrey Young's identified 18 of these schemas. And the schemas are defined further by the maladaptive coping strategies that people use to deal with the pain of their schemas when they get triggered through interactions with others or situations. And so the idea of this book came about from my private practice dealing with couples and also individuals when we're dealing with this common issue of criticism. And for couples who have this interaction, it can have a really destructive effect on relationships and on the well-being of the partner who is the victim of criticism.
So our childhood is key to the schema that we're playing out, correct? I just want to make sure we really understand what the schema is and how it applies to this particular book.
Right. So I've identified five primary schemas for the vulnerable partner and five primary schemas for the critical partner. And the book explains how these schemas come about. And there's an assessment piece for the vulnerable partner so that they can identify their schema, which can be really empowering. And then there's an assessment piece for them to identify their partner's schemas. What makes this really interesting is that four of the schemas for the vulnerable partner and the critical partner are actually the same, but they look very different because in the case of the critical partner, they're overcompensating for their schema with their behavior, which means that they're behaving the opposite of what they believe about themselves. And in the case of the vulnerable partner, they're surrendering to their schema. So they're behaving in a way that confirms their core beliefs. So if we were looking at a critical partner with a defectiveness and shame schema, he or she would more than likely criticize and reject others while appearing to be perfect. And in the case of the vulnerable partner with the same schema, they would probably put themselves down and choose critical or rejecting partners.
Okay. So you said just that you'd identified five schemas that are typical in critical partners. And I want to just run through those. So these are patterns of relating to others that are deeply entrenched in us. And the five schemas could be shame could be one. Unrelenting standards imposed on them by others could be another. Distrust, fear of abandonment, and fear of deprivation. And each one of those, if we have one of those schemas, each one we kind of act out differently, as you just mentioned. So,
correct.
One thing that interested me when I read the book, and maybe you can just elaborate on this a little, you know, in most self-help books, for want of a better phrase, we look first at ourselves and then we look at people around us. In this book, you start with, if we read it in a linear fashion, of course, we go chapter by chapter, you start with identifying your partner's schema, what's their typical pattern of relating, and then you look at why that makes us vulnerable, and then you look at our own way of interacting. So I wonder if you'd just talk about that a little and why it's important to do it that way.
Why I put it in that order.
Yeah.
I think that in order to get to a place where you really want to put some effort in, sometimes it's difficult to find the motivation to move forward and make necessary changes that can make your relationship better. This dynamic that you're in can seem really unhealthy, it's also very comfortable and familiar. One of the key pieces to identifying your critical partner's schema is to create some, not just understanding, but some empathy for your partner. And I think it always makes it easier to deal with someone when you can find that vulnerability in them. And in this case, it's that they had some unmet need as a child, in some cases abuse, whether it was physical or emotional deprivation or abandonment. And to be able to access that piece of your partner, I think, makes it easier to find the place inside of yourself that makes you want to heal the relationship.
Right, because they may well not know they have issues from childhood. So I guess that's another reason to start there too. But, you know, I would think ideally a couple would want to work through this book together. But if you have a partner who isn't willing, if your partner is the critical partner and is not willing to work with you, you can still make a difference, you say, in a relationship by going through and identifying his or her schema and our own schema.
Right. And then starting to integrate some of the alternative coping strategies, which are finding new ways to communicate so that you're not playing into the unhealthy dynamic of the exchange. So there, as I'm sure you found, lots of examples in the book about how certain responses to a criticism can escalate the negative cycle between the couple, and that changing your response and getting in touch with what it is that you're really hearing, what your partner's saying. I mean, in this case, obviously your partner is critical, but it can also get magnified by things like cognitive distortion. So, you know, there's an example in the book that I give about this woman who felt really criticized by her mother growing up. Her mother favored her sister, thought she was more attractive. So when this woman's husband was really critical of her about the way that she was dressing, it took on even more power for her, and it was even more emotionally devastating for her. And to be able to identify that in yourself is also, I think, really key in trying to communicate to your partner that what they're saying is not only unacceptable, but taking it further and explaining what else is going on with them when they hear that.
Right. So let's look at one of the critical partner schemas. Let's say that our partner has had unrelenting standards imposed on them by others, and you say, you know, what kind of characteristics would we see in them? What kind of behaviors would we see come out of them if they've been raised with that unlimited, you know, those unrealistic expectations? Can't get my words out.
Well, one of the, I think, do you mean like if they were, the five schemas for the critical partner are entitlement, defectiveness and shame, abandonment, mistrust and abuse, and emotional deprivation. So are you talking about the defectiveness and shame schema? There is an unrelenting standards schema,
right,
but it's not one of the ones that's identified in the book.
Okay, so that, let's look at the defectiveness and shame, because you mentioned earlier that somebody who's been raised and has that schema entrenched in them may come off as superior when they're really feeling very inferior.
Exactly. So they really see themselves as being bad or unwanted or inferior. They fear becoming unlovable to a partner if their true self were exposed.
Mm-hmm.
And so they will behave toward their partner in a way that they act superior, they can present as perfect, and they can be really critical. There's an individual in the book who has the defectiveness and shame schema of the critical partner, and he his schema gets triggered in the presence of people who are successful. And so with his partner, he became very critical around her friends and with her, and acted very superior. And truly, his pain was that he felt like he was really a bad person, and he was rejected by his mother in favor of his sister, and it was really taking a toll on the relationship.
And another one that you talk about, and the reason I'm picking out these two is because I did a very, I threw a quick question out on Facebook about, you know, is your partner controlling, critical, excuse me.
Yes.
And the key, I guess the major two areas were really communication and controlling. And
right.
Somebody who has a schema of entitlement, you say their core emotion is anger. Their worldview is that they feel superior to others and deserving of special attention or treatment.
Right.
But their behavior toward their partner is very controlling, manipulative, and selfish.
Yes.
So how would we deal with that, for example, if I've identified that that's my partner's MO, and then I go and I identify my schema, and you can pick a schema for me, I don't care. How would we then go about dealing with somebody who has that sense of entitlement?
Right. Well, I think, you know, it helps to, of course, bring that to awareness. And because the only way to part of what you're doing is behaving in a way that's going to help reduce, de-escalate, or heal your schema, and that's by replacing your maladaptive or self-defeating behavior patterns with adaptive and healthy behavior patterns. And so part of that is to get clear on what it is that your experience is specifically in the relationship. So there's a piece about mindfulness and being really aware in the moment of what is going on and staying in the present, observing your thoughts and feelings about what is going on. And if you can't deal with your partner at that moment, one of the alternative coping strategies is to call a timeout, which is to say, I hear what you're saying. I can't have a conversation with you about this right now. Let's come back together when we're both in a better place, not as emotional. And really, at when you come back together, have a dialogue about what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
The change is challenging and it's not easy. And the fact of the matter is that these schemas never go away, that we can only behave in a way that helps to reduce them or de-escalate them, that really works toward not having responding in a way when our schemas get triggered and recognizing when they get triggered and choosing an adaptive, healthy way to respond,
right.
And knowing that also our partner's schema isn't going to change, but bringing their schema to awareness and what it is that made them the way that they are also can make it easier to take the journey to try to make the change so that you can get to a healthier place in your relationship.
Yeah, none of this is about excusing bad behavior. It is about
trying to feel
that. We've got 2 minutes left. And I want to ask you very quickly, because we all know that listening is a huge part of communication.
It is.
And, you know, we put a lot of roadblocks in our own way, which you discuss in the book and
mm-hmm.
give some counter productive ways that we can overcome those. But you talk about an awareness interview. And if we could just cover this in like 60 seconds, what's the point of having an awareness interview? What would you expect to see or hear in an effective and productive awareness interview?
Well, I think that, I mentioned earlier about cognitive distortions, and the awareness interview is a way to overcome those so that we're really clear on what it is that our partner is saying to us and that they are really clear on what we are saying to them. So this is asking your partner a question, and this has to be done, it has to be conducted when there isn't high emotional affect on the part of either of the people. And you ask a question, and then you repeat your partner's answer back to them so that it's clear that you're understanding what they're saying, and then they will correct you if you have distorted what they're saying or misunderstood. And the same is true for the way that they ask you the question and repeat back to you. And the idea behind the awareness interview is for both partners to develop a greater awareness of each other and each other's experiences. And a lot of times the schemas can get in the way of our perceptions about ourselves and our partner. And So it's becoming really clear about what is going on for each of you and what both of you are experiencing in this exchange.
Sounds
and
good.
I have an example of a couple who were dealing with conflict, and they used the awareness interview as a way to work through it.
Okay, sounds good. Great information in this book. If you have a critical partner, it's work, but I definitely think it would be worth doing it. And it's called, the book is called The Critical Partner, How to End the Cycle of Criticism and Get the Love You Want, written by Dr. Michelle Skeen. And you can find out more about Dr. Michelle Skeen at michelleskeen.com.
Michelle. And thecriticalpartner.com.
And the critical.
Vicky, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. Good work. Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And please do stay with us, everyone. We'll be right back. I'm not going to say his name until I know how to pronounce it this time. But we will be talking about the power of the physician's touch and also about his new novel, Cutting the Stone. Please do stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Merry Christmas. I don't want to fight tonight with...
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicky at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job and building your business, overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL. Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Do you have a writer in your life or someone who wants to write but needs help? Give the gift of creative coaching to encourage their passion this holiday season. Vicky St. Clair has been writing professionally for more than 15 years. She can help jumpstart new writers and unblock experienced writers. Each program is tailored to suit a writer's individual needs and can be a single, one-off consultation or multiple coaching sessions. Vicky can also help you navigate the publishing world and explore ways to make over six figures a year with your craft. See more about Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com. For creative coaching details, call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772. Or email Vicky at VickySt.Clair.com.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Listen to podcasts of past shows at conversationslive.net.
Clear, clean, and crisp. Check us out in digital quality sound on FM 98.9 HD3. Alternative Talk 1150.
Merry Christmas. Well, my next guest is Dr. Abraham Verghese. He has a very, very interesting background and some interesting philosophies. He is the professor and senior associate chair for the theory and practice of medicine at the Stanford University School of Medicine. He was the founding director of the Center for Medical Humanities and Ethics at the University of Texas Health Science Center, where he's now an adjunct professor. And he's the author of My Own Country, a 1994 NBCC finalist and a Time Best Book of the Year, and The Tennis Partner, which was a New York Times notable. And his new book has actually, it's not that new. It's been out for 90 weeks and is still on the New York Times bestseller list, 90 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list. I'd like to welcome Dr. Abraham Verghese to the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Vicky. Great to be on your show.
And I should say, your first two books were nonfiction. This book is a fiction book. It's called Cutting the Stone, and we're definitely going to get to that in just a moment. But I want to talk a little bit about some of the articles you've written. You're a very prolific writer. You're not just somebody who decided to author a book one day. I mean, you are a writer. And a couple of the articles that I'd pulled out, I want to share the titles with our listeners because I think that will show them where you're coming from. There was a great piece called Bedside Manners. You say you were taught to tap and thump your patients and listen for the sounds of sickness and health. And another one in the New York Times called Treat the Patient, Not the CT Scan. So I know you're a very big believer in the power of touch, and you think that as physicians that has been lost over the years. Tell us a little bit about why you have such a strong belief in this philosophy.
You know, I think there's a great overlap between my writing and my professional work. The same monomania informs both of them. And I've always felt that, you know, that there's so much about medicine that revolves around listening to the patient. And there are so many obvious diseases that one can diagnose by examining the patient. And we've been able to do this for about 100 years. And paradoxically, as technology has sort of advanced, we've gotten to the point where if you come to a hospital missing a leg, no one will believe you till they get a CAT scan, MRI, and orthopedic consult. It's almost as though we doubt our own senses. And the downside of that is I think we order lots of unnecessary tests. But more than that, I think we wind up missing very obvious diagnoses that don't require much more than a physician carefully examining the patient. But at yet another level, I think that there's an important ritual aspect to the exam. I don't want to make too much of it, but I will just say this, that you know, one individual coming to another and telling them things that they wouldn't tell their rabbi or preacher, and then incredibly disrobing and allowing touch. You know, this has all the hallmarks of a ritual. In any other context, this would be assault. But in the context of a patient-physician exam, it is an important part of the ritual. And I think that to the degree that we skimp on the ritual, or we, you know, just stick our stethoscope on the nightgown, or don't do a good belly exam, and, you know, quite apart from what we're missing on the patient, we're also shortchanging a ritual that I think is deeply meaningful. And in my practice, when I was taking care of people with chronic fatigue, I would often sense that they had seen many other people and they'd come to me. And if they accepted my recommendations and sort of gave up the quest for the magic doctor, the magic treatment, the magic test, and instead began a partnership with me towards wellness, I often felt it was because I had earned the right to tell them these things because I listened well and examined them thoroughly. And in completing that ritual, I sealed the patient-physician relationship. So my emphasis on touch is not to suggest that there's a healing touch or things like that, mm-hmm. but more to say this is how you connect, and we are shortchanging ourselves in medicine if we don't do that.
Now, I would think your upbringing had something to do with this. I read that you were born of Indian parents. They were teachers in Ethiopia. When you attended medical school, you did it so on two continents. And you talk about your first clinical professor in East Africa who taught you how to literally place your fingers on the wrists of patients and recognize the slapping of the water hammer, as you call it. How much influence did that have on you?
Yeah, that had a very powerful influence on me. I think I was drawn especially to this idea of, you know, entering medical school and learning the specialized language, and more than that, learning a special way, almost a magical way of looking at another human being and discerning all these things that were not apparent to a layperson. And to me, that was the great mystery and romance of embarking on a medical education. And the irony is that we still teach all that stuff to our medical students, and, you know, teach it with some enthusiasm in my case, because I believe in it. And yet we teach it in the first 2 years, and when they come to the wards in their third year of medical school, very often they quickly sort of see that no one else is carrying, you know, knee hammers and ophthalmoscopes and tuning forks, and, you know, that the currency of the current medical care revolves around the computer.
Right.
In fact, I've coined a term, the eye patient, to describe
right.
the entity in the computer, you know, like your iPhone, your iPod. The eye patient is the virtual, you know, entity, which in many ways is more real to many of us as we're going on day to day, because that's where everything's happening. And the patient in the bed sadly becomes, there's some danger that the patient in the bed becomes an icon for the real patient who's in the computer. And that is something that we are trying very hard to counter, because I think clearly patient satisfaction relates to this fact that they can't figure out who's in charge, who's going to come and tell them what's going on, you know, what exactly transpired today. Even though we think we're on top of everything, we haven't communicated that to the patient very well, I'm afraid.
Right.
And that disjunction is something that greatly interests me.
You write in that same article, Bedside Manners, that you recognize that you're an incurable romantic. But I was really surprised to hear how much you can tell by literally touching somebody and feeling a pulse. Or, you know, you talked about this doctor who taught you putting, you know, you could hear the leaky valve. So how do you bring that into Stanford when you're teaching students? How do you bring that in and have them take this seriously?
Well, I mean, it's all around us. It's very evident that you could still do all those things. And what's lovely is that we have now 100 ways to confirm that what you're suspecting, in fact, exists. And we're finding out that some of these old saws, the things we were taught, don't exactly hold up as well mm-hmm. as we thought they did. But so much of it holds up very well. And I find it useful in the following fashion. I think that if you are the kind of physician who takes a good history and examines the patient well and is skilled at it, you wind up sort of not ordering tests to fish. You order tests to confirm things that your history and physical led you to confirm, rather than going on this fishing expedition by checking off as many boxes as you can think of and hope that the diagnosis falls out of the sky in some fashion.
Mm.
So I think it's not, I'm not a Luddite. I'm working in Stanford at a place where we're doing cutting-edge research, and I embrace all that, but I think the technology is meant to serve us. For example, you know, we had a patient show up here some time ago with a blood pressure of 250 over 170 and proceeded to collapse in the emergency room and was resuscitated and, you know, in a very tenuous situation, taken to the CAT scan suite to get a CAT scan looking for blood clots in her lung, only to find that she had no blood clots in her lung. She had breast masses in both breasts that had tumors that had widely metastasized. And these masses in the breast were visible, palpable, and she had had about 4 or 5 encounters with healthcare institutions in the preceding 2 years. 4 or 5 opportunities to intervene, maybe even make a difference. And she didn't get the diagnosis, not because we didn't have fancy machines, but because no one, you know, examined her well. And again, there might have been cultural reasons why she didn't volunteer that she had these masses. But
right.
I think that so much of that is happening. Our radiology friends tell us this is a common story. We're often ordering tests for some other reason, only to be told by someone looking at an image on a screen, by the way, your patient has a breast mass or your patient has this or that, which should have been apparent. And our current medical records, the computerized medical records, are wonderful, you know, sort of records of what is meant to have happened, but I don't really believe anything in there much anymore. You know, it's almost like a form of fiction. The drop-down boxes say, oh, heart is normal and reflexes intact and this was done and that was done, but you really get the sense that they're just clicking off boxes to complete a document that looks legal and official.
Right. Well,
it doesn't represent the truth.
Yeah, and I think having read so much of your work, which I did over this weekend, I am myself going to insist that my doctor does swizzle around from the computer and actually look at me next time I go in.
Yeah.
Good, technology is a good tool, as you said. So let's talk a little bit about your book and how you poured some of your philosophies into your book. It's called Cutting the Stone. And it's been on the New York Times bestseller list for 90 weeks. Long, long time. It was declared by National Public Radio the best book club book of the year. You've won all kinds of awards on this book. Tell us a little bit about the story and how it got started for you.
Well, I had always wanted to write a book that would capture, for me, what was this romantic voyage into medicine as a medical student, and more of the romance of medicine, its ups and downs. And I think a generation of us in medicine were called to medicine because of a book. Not so much anymore, where I think television and movies rule, but in America, the book was Arrowsmith, and in England, it was The Citadel by A.J. Cronin. And for me, it happened to be Of Human Bondage by Somerset Maugham. And there was some element in that book, a very minor medical theme that just made medicine seem to me this fascinating journey that I couldn't, as a young reader, imagine doing anything else. And I part of my ambition was to do that, to write a book that would, I thought, capture the essence of what I had so much enjoyed about medicine. But my ambition was also to completely situate the novel in medicine. I mean, I'm a big fan of Emile Zola and his novels of Paris, where every page seems to sort of reek of Paris. You can almost smell it.
Right.
And I wanted every page of my book to reek of Dettol and pus and blood and every character to be involved in medicine in some way. And the fact that it's captured the public imagination is a great joy for me. I think it's because I think there's some common theme there that resonates with all of us. A wonderful American writer, Dorothy Allison, says that fiction is the great lie that tells the truth about how the world lives. And so I think when the story succeeds, it's because there is a great lie in there that tells the truth about how we live. And to me, that great lie is that love is redemptive, and that, you know, that our connections with other people are ultimately what give meaning to our lives. You know, it's probably the same old themes coming back again, but somehow that story seemed to do it.
Right. It's been described as Cutting for Stone has been described as an unforgettable story of love and betrayal, medicine and ordinary miracles, and two brothers whose fates are forever intertwined. What would you tell us, just give us an overarching overview of the story itself?
Sure. So it begins with a nun by the name of Sister Mary Joseph Praise giving birth to twins in a mission hospital in Africa. And she actually succumbs during childbirth, and one of the twins becomes the narrator for the story. And, of course, the great shock in that hospital is that the nun is not only pregnant, but about to deliver. And everyone, you know, tries to imagine who the father could be, and everyone assumes it's an English surgeon by the name of Thomas Stone who works there. He doesn't deny it. He actually thinks he may well be the father, but for the life of him, he can't imagine how it transpired. And the great conceit of the book is that you don't really find out till the very end whether, in fact, he is the father and how it happened. But meanwhile, it's this boy's, one of the twins, his precocious adventure through medicine and his journey to try and find out his father and get at the truth of what happened. So I hope it's a good romp, and that readers, you know, enjoy the journey, enjoy the language, and enjoy being introduced to a part of the world that I don't think is in many novels. The novel is set in Ethiopia, and I think I really enjoyed making geography a character, because people tell me, you know, I had all these presuppositions about Ethiopia, but you really helped me see the land and see the people in a completely new and refreshing way, which is a great pleasure to hear.
Absolutely, and I think 90 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list say something.
Yeah.
I want to just ask you this, because Cutting for Stone, people might wonder why that title, and I read a couple of critiques on the book, which were very good, but one of them said, you know, I didn't understand, I loved the title, but I didn't understand why it was called that until I got into the Hippocratic Oath. So tell us how you came up with the title for that.
You know, I always had that title from very early on. The novel, I mean, the phrase "cutting for stone" is a phrase in the Hippocratic Oath, where every year the highlight of my year is to stand with my medical students as they take the oath. You know, kids I've worked with for 4 years, and it always struck me as so strange that we would recite these ancient lines that had no real bearing on our lives today. And one such line was, "I will not cut for stone, but leave it to those who are skilled in the art." And the phrase stems from an era in medieval times and later when bladder stones, kidney stones were epidemic. I mean, you can't imagine little kids dying with grapefruit-sized stones in their bladder, dying in agony. And it was causing so much, you know, death and destruction. And there were these itinerant stone cutters or surgeons who would go from city to city, and they were very adept at doing this dangerous operation and taking the stone out and relieving the suffering. And, of course, then they would wipe their blade on their cassock and head off to the next operation. The patient would probably die the next day or so from infection. But they relieved suffering, and yet it was not something you should attempt if you didn't know what you were doing.
Mm.
I just like the ring of the line, and I think that titles, I think, should be slightly mysterious, and you hope that there are moments that the reader comes to in a book where they say, aha, now I see
right. What
the title means, or it resonates for me in this way. And readers will often ask me or write to me and say, well, what exactly does the title mean? And I'm not being facetious when I say to them, it means whatever you think it means. You know, because at a certain point, I think the reader owns the book. You know, that the whole joy of reading is that it's this partnership with the writer, where the writer has the words, but you have the imagination, and you construct your own characters and your own meaning that have so much to do with who you are, rather than following some formula that the author prescribes. So the characters are named Stone. Thomas Stone is the surgeon. His sons are Stone. So it can mean a lot of things. It can mean one twin, you know, trying to find father. It could mean one surgeon operating for another. It has many levels of meaning.
Right. Well, we have about a minute left in the segment, Dr. Verghese, and I want to just ask you this. You say you have a note on your wall that reads, "You must remember this." What does that mean?
Well, I think there's always moments in our lives where something happens, and we have a sense of not just deja vu, but that this is a moment that's going to resonate for us in the future in some way. And I've wound up using that phrase in all three of my books at some point, because you stumble on these moments. Sometimes it's as simple as walking down the street and seeing the way the light hits a woman's face or bounces off a tree, and just stop because it resonates with something, or it will one day, or it's a phrase, and that's all I mean by that.
Well, I thank you for being with us today. Really appreciate it. And I want to let our listeners know they can find a great video of you on TEDtalk.com.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and you talk more about the power of your belief in the physical touch.
Thanks for having me, Vicky.
Yeah, my pleasure, my pleasure. And Dr. Verghese's book, again, is called Cutting for Stone. You can find out more about him at his website, and I'll spell that out for you. It's Abraham Verghese, VerghEse.com, AbrahamVerghese.com. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And please stay with us when we come back. We'll be joined by legendary broadcaster Larry Kane. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
My heart was open as she put a mask on me. I'm breathing, but it's become a chore. Now that you've seen the doctor, don't call me anymore.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
If you want to reach a large audience of like-minded people, people with integrity, people who strive to live well and live strong, let Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair shine a spotlight on your message. Tell us about your business, product, service, or event, and we'll help you craft your message and promote your good work. Email Vicky at conversationslive.net or call 425-269-4772. That's 425-269-4772.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Alternative Talk 1150 is now being broadcast in digital quality on FM 98.9 HD3. So rejoice, you early adopters of technology.
And welcome back, everyone. Well, we're now talking with Larry Kane. He's known as the Dean of Philadelphia Television News Anchor and has been one of the market's most respected broadcast journalists for more than 40 years. I think it's more like 45, but we'll talk with him
it's
in a 45. Moment. 45. Larry Kane is the current host of The Voice of Reason. He is the only anchor to have worked at all three network-owned stations in the Philadelphia region. He's a special contributor for KYW News Radio, an occasional writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, and has authored three books in the last 6 years. His new novel is called Death by Deadline. Welcome, Larry King. Welcome.
Thank you, Vicki. It's great to be on the air.
Well, as we said, you've recently celebrated 45 years in TV, radio, broadcasting. You left daily anchoring in 2003, but you certainly haven't retired, and I suspect that word's not really in your vocabulary.
No, the problem I have is trying to figure out what retirement is. I haven't figured that out yet, so I'm working on it.
So let's just jump straight into the book, because we don't have a lot of time, and I want to make sure we talk about this book, because I'm always fascinated myself by... I love stories about journalists. I love good journalists, and they are unfortunately few and far between today. But why did you write this book? It's called Death by Deadline: Can Out of Control Local News Kill People?
Well, first of all, it took me 12 years to write the book because it's fiction, fiction based on reality. Because you never know if it really could happen. My guess is it could. It's a book that is filled with murder and intrigue and. A certain level of violence and sex appeal. But more than that, it's a Mark Bowden, who wrote Black Hawk Down, is a good friend, calls it a murder mystery with a serious message. And the message is that local news in America, tragically, has lost almost 34 to 37% of audience in the last 12 years. And you can blame it on the internet, blame it on the iPhone, blame it on this or that, but the fact remains that local news has ceased to be relevant because it concentrates on two areas of our life, weather, which is very important, but also violence. And violence is important. It can't be sanitized. But the fact is that there are big issues out there that local news is not covering, the environment, education. Maybe in Seattle it is, maybe in Northwest Washington, because there may be a higher level of interest. But the stories about local school boards, the stories about how people try to shape our society, politics in general, these are the stories that people want, and they're really kind of looking at their 10 or 11 o'clock newscast and saying, you know, that's not relevant to me anymore. This story is a horror story about what happens when local news runs amok, when information, bad information can, and I hate to say this, but it's happened, kill people. and that information gone wild is as dangerous as a car streaking toward you at 90 miles an hour with no brakes. And in this book, we explore that. We also have some humor, and we also explore the world of anchors, fear, and loathing. And when the anchor man in this book goes to his boss and says he wants to kill the co-anchor, he's not talking about giving her a pink slip. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
So it's kind of exciting. It's fun. And I could have written a book with a rant about the business, but I decided to turn it into a mystery. And I can't go into it right now, but I can tell you that Hollywood is interested.
Oh, very good.
Which means that they will mangle the entire story.
Well, I actually think it would make a good movie. David Cohen, the executive vice president of Comcast, says it's a page-turning morality play that may be a wake-up call to some local news directors around the country.
Well, I'll tell you something interesting, Vicki. Some television stations have put me on, local TV, to talk about it. So they're not afraid of the book. Well, I think that a lot of people in the business find it healthy. Now, I must say that, you know, the TV stations in Seattle do have a higher standard when it comes to covering these kinds of good stories, the stories that are important to people. So I don't think this was really tailored after the Seattle market. I mean, you got some great journalism in Seattle.
We do. I made a very, very short documentary about 10 years ago, and I can't say with which station, but the thing I took away from that was that, you know, those cliches, if it bleeds, it leads. If you're dead, we're alive. And
well, it's also, you know, some of those stories are important, but there's a point where you cross a line. It's cheap to cover violence. You just send a camera guy out, camera woman out. They take the picture and you do it. But is the violence in this book, for example, there's a news director who questions whether violence, whether a death in a black neighborhood of Philadelphia is as important as a death in a white neighborhood. That's a horrible decision to make.
Yeah. Now, you've spent all of your career in Philadelphia. You've actually written a book called Philadelphia. Is there any of you in a protagonist in this book?
Well, I am, unfortunately, in the book. But in this book, I am a washed-up anchor man who is at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book in different ways fighting for his life because of a calamity caused by bad information and inappropriate and profane tips. And what happened was it was a snowy day and I wasn't in the newsroom, and I got caught and stuck and almost killed in the story, the biggest story I ever missed. And so my continuing fight to struggle through this book is a mystery until you get it at the end. And it's some wonderful characters.
Right. And I just want to reemphasize there that this is fiction. This is a fiction book.
This is a book. And by the way, there's a lot of anchors who feel they're in the book.
I bet.
That would be the headline of narcissism, that they're in the book. But I will tell you right now that this book is not about any individual who is alive on television right now, but it's really a composite. And you meet some interesting people, like the young producer who asked me who Malcolm the Tenth was. And I said, Malcolm the Tenth. She says, yeah, the almanac says Malcolm Roman numeral the Tenth. I said, you mean Malcolm X? And then the I. Reinhorn story, I'm sure you remember him, the guy who killed his girlfriend and escaped around the world.
Right.
And the district attorney, this really happened, by the way. District Attorney of Philadelphia announced at a news conference they were going to try him in absentia. And a reporter said, where is absentia? And she said, just below the Philadelphia city line. So, you know, there's some fun. And there's an anchorman who gets caught in the worst possible scenario in public with his zipper going in the wrong direction.
Right.
And, so we have a lot of and there's a lot of intellectual properties in this book. And it's fun, but it's also serious. And
right.
We'll see.
Well, we're almost at the end of our segment, Larry. It goes by so quick. The book is Death by Deadline. Can out-of-control local news kill people? And as you can see, Larry has a sense of humor about this, too. I want to ask you in like 30 seconds real quick, because I know that you have covered 21 political conventions since 1964.
There'll be two more next year.
Yeah, what two more next year. What do you think of Donald Trump facilitating some of the debates?
I think Donald Trump is facilitating a debate is like me fixing the plumbing system of a house.
Thank you.
I don't think he has any reason or obligation. He has a right to, but I think he's a very... very demagogic, kind of dangerous person.
Right.
Not my favorite person to, as a symbol of American democracy.
Well,
and by the way, this book is online, all the services, it's anywhere you need it.
Right, right. And we've got to run. We're right at the end of our show. I thank you so much for being with us, Larry.
Vicky, thanks for having me on.
Sure. You can find out more about Larry at larrykane.com and more about his work that he's doing right now and his books. And we'll be back next week. Until then, I'm actually going to take a couple of weeks off for the holiday, but I'll be back with live with you soon. Until then, live well, live strong, have the most wonderful holidays. Thanks for being with us.